Good evening, and it's a pleasure to welcome you here all this evening, on a very hot evening, to the last of this year's Miliband Lectures on States and Markets in a Global Age. Last, but of course not least, for it's a particular pleasure to welcome Michael Sandel to the LSE to speak actually more directly than anyone on the theme of the series, and his title tonight is just perfect for the series, Keeping Markets in Their Place, Markets and Morals in a Global Age. Michael is Professor of Government at Harvard, in case you needed reminding, and is the author of many publications, including Public Philosophy, Essays on Morality and Politics, published last year, Liberalism and the Limits of Justice, there have been two editions, but the second was 1997, and a book widely read here, Democracy's Discontent, published in the mid-1990s. He's the author, of course, of many scholarly articles and some general essays which have appeared in such diverse places as the Atlantic Monthly, New Republic, and the New York Times. He's been a visiting professor in several places, including the Sorbonne in 2001, and delivered the well-known Tanner Lectures on Human Values at Oxford at the end of the 1990s. From 2002 to 5, particularly interestingly, he served on the President's Council on Bioethics, a national body appointed by the US President to examine the ethical implications of the new biomedical technologies. He's lectured widely to various audiences, North America, Europe, Japan, India, among many other places. Please join me in welcoming our very distinguished visitor, and please join with me in giving him a particularly warm appreciation.
Well, thank you, David, very much for those warm words of welcome. And let's see if I can peer out from this formidable podium to say that it's a special honor to be here to give a lecture in the name of Ralph Miliband. I knew him by reputation, but also had an opportunity to meet him. He was, he taught at Brandeis University toward the end of his career, and I was an undergraduate at Brandeis, not while he was there, but after I did my graduate work in the UK. I went back for a year to Brandeis while I was finishing my dissertation and had the privilege of meeting him. And I understand this lecture series is a way of honoring and preserving the critical spirit that he brought to the study of society and politics and economics. So it's a special honor to be here in a lectureship in his name. My subject is keeping markets in their place, which has always been a challenge for politics ever since the advent of market economies. And it's a special challenge now for reasons that David Held and all of the speakers in this series have made us all aware of, because of the advancing significance of globalization, the breaking down of boundaries, and especially national boundaries, with respect to the movement of capital and goods and people. Now, the boundaries between nation states are not the only traditional limits to the role of and the reach of markets. Many of the social practices that restrain the reach of markets and of market values arise from aspects of our lives, whether social institutions, norms, traditions and practices that depend on sources of value other than use. And the question arises when markets reach into spheres of life, spheres of social life, personal life, moral life, and civic life, traditionally governed by other norms. The question arises, do they belong there? And if they don't, what values
and what resources, social and political resources, can be summoned to constrain them. Now, this is a big question of politics and also of philosophy. It's a question of politics because what we need now, so it seems to me, in an age of globalization, is a public debate about the proper scope and reach of markets. Where should the markets writ run and where shouldn't it? It's also a philosophical question, though, because in order to answer that political question, or even to debate it, we have to have some principles or at least some considerations to reflect on, to argue about, to bring to bear, to decide what sorts of goods and social practices are undermined, eroded, diminished, or degraded if crowded out by market practices and market norms. So that's really my question. What I take to be my question is a fairly straightforward one. Are there some goods that money shouldn't buy? And if there are, what is it about those goods that gives them that character? That's the philosophical question, and that's the question I'm going to try to talk some about, though I'll try in the end to bring it back to the question of politics. If we look around us, we find that market values and market assumptions are reaching into spheres of life that we never even thought about as needing to be immune from market pressures until relatively recently. Take one very concrete case, having nothing directly to do with politics, books. Now, books have always been commodities in the sense that if you go into a bookstore, want to walk out with the book, you have to pay for it. So books have long been bought and sold and therefore have been commodities in that sense. There are libraries and there are bookstores, and we understand the difference between the two. But what I mean by the extension of the reach of markets can be seen even with the example of books. Although books were commodities in the sense that you had to buy one if you wanted to acquire it, books also embody certain norms that, at least on the face of it, are at odds with marketizing and commercializing pressures. And we see this if we notice the fact that today books are commodities in a more thoroughgoing sense than ever before. Now, we're familiar with the practice of product placement in movies, in film. Probably seen or heard about the fact, or certainly on television. Television, except for public television, runs advertising. Usually the advertisements are confined to segments between the actual television program. In some cases now, television programming is incorporating the ads into the programs themselves, sometimes surreptitiously. In movies, companies will pay to have products. The latest James Bond movie, it was rife with product placement, wasn't it? I haven't seen it, but I've read about it. Did anyone see the latest? It's not the real James Bond, it's some successor. But the watch he wore, for example, was, what was the watch? You didn't see it either, David.
I wouldn't notice the watch.
It was one of these very expensive watches, and there were billboards advertising the watch and James Bond, and in the movie he wore the watch and so on. This is too...
Anyone with one of these watches should just make it known.
This is too pure an audience to know those kinds of references. But now, even books are the subject of product placement. Some years ago, there was an author who was commissioned to write a book. Her name is Faye Weldon. Do people know of her?
Sure.
Yeah. You know her better than you know James Bond.
Yeah, we do.
She was commissioned, did you read about this, to write a book commissioned by the Bulgari Jewelry Company. And the contract specified that she had to mention the name of Bulgari X number of times in the book. It's not that they put an ad on the back of the book. And the title of the novel was, not surprisingly, The Bulgari Connection. And one person took a look at this book, counted 34 mentions of Bulgari and 15 other rhapsodies of jewelry. Mostly they stick out on the page, the reviewer said, like a boulder in the sand. For example, quote, a Bulgari necklace in the hand is worth two in the bush. Here's another example. They snuggled together happily for a bit, all passion spent, and she met him at Bulgari that lunchtime. So here you have markets and market practices reaching in, this is before we even get to the political question, reaching in to make books into a commodity in a deeper, more thoroughgoing way than ever before. And even more recently, there's a British novelist, you won't have heard of her, David, I hope not. She's a chick lit writer.
Sure, we know those.
Called Carol Matthews. Have you ever heard of her? She wrote a book geared to young women where she contracted with the Ford Motor Company, the British division, to make favorable references to the Ford Fiesta car. Did you hear about that? Here. And there was, have you heard of, there's another bigger chick lit author called Helen Fielding. Have you heard of her?
No, you've heard of her.
The Ford spokesperson said, I did try to get Helen Fielding, but she's considerably more expensive. So this author they engage with, she also writes short stories for the Ford website. One example of the way she incorporates it into her stories is the heroine finds herself drag racing against, quote, an incredible hunk at a corporate team building exercise. Before the race, Juliet, the heroine, wonders whether whizzing around Buckinghamshire in my rather snazzy Ford Fiesta, complete with 6 CD changer and air conditioning, has adequately prepared me for this. So, books is a very concrete, that palpable, small example of how market thinking, market values, reach into a practice that we never thought of as a bulwark against markets. We just didn't realize the extent to which books, reading, literature as a social practice can be commodified. Well, most of us, I assume, I mean, you can raise your hand and say to the contrary if you disagree, most of us find this, well, tacky at best and troubling. You, David, is that a fair, you would say?
Well, my books are available for product placement anytime. anyone should be interested. They probably don't sell enough to justify it. But we understand the point you're making.
Okay. But the interesting philosophical question is that just that we have to kind of get over it and get with the program of the new capitalism, or are there some moral reasons or other philosophically informed reasons or principles that can help us figure out where markets belong and where they don't? Are there some things that money shouldn't buy, like the content of books? In order to address this question, though, I'd like to begin, and I propose that we begin by a slightly different question. Are there some things money can't buy? Now, there are. One familiar example is friendship. Suppose you want more friends than you have. you probably wouldn't think of going out and buying one. Why not? Well, you don't have to be a moral philosopher to answer that question. It wouldn't work. A bought friend isn't the same as a real one, though he or she might be a useful therapist, which is akin to a friend, but not the same thing. Somehow the money that seeks to buy the friendship corrupts it, or at least turns it into something else. So friendship is a good example of something that money can't buy. Consider another example, the Nobel Prize. Suppose you desperately want, raise your hand if you do, a Nobel Prize but haven't yet won one. Would you think about buying one if they were for sale? You wouldn't. You most likely wouldn't. Not for any reasons necessarily of moral scruples, but because a bought Nobel Prize wouldn't work. It wouldn't work in the sense of giving you the good you wanted in the first place. And the reason it wouldn't, well, you could buy the trophy or the medallion if some previous winner wanted to sell it to you, but you couldn't buy the prize. And the reason you couldn't is that the market exchange, as with the case of friendship, the market exchange immediately dissolves the good that you were seeking. And the reason in the case of the Nobel Prize is that it's an honorific good. If word got out that the prize had been bought, the award wouldn't convey or express the honor that people associate with the real thing. Well, these fairly obvious cases can help us, here's my suggestion, think about a related but different question, whether there are some things that money can buy but shouldn't. Consider a case that can't be dealt with as easily as the friendship case or the Nobel Prize case, kidneys. There is a debate now in the US and in some other parts of the world about whether there should be markets in the sale of organs for transplantation. Now, money can buy a kidney, assuming it's a good match. If there were a market for kidneys for transplantation, the fact that I bought one would not dissolve the good that I seek, assuming it's a good match. Whether I bought it or not would have no bearing. So in that respect, there are some things that money can buy. They'll work perfectly well. The good will persist, but it's still an open question whether morally there ought to be markets in kidneys. Another example would be baby selling. There's the founder of the Law and Economics School, Richard Posner, a federal judge, a Chicago economist lawyer, once wrote an article advocating the use of markets to allocate babies up for adoption. Baby selling, in effect. Let the market set the price. More attractive kids would fetch higher prices, and with a discount for ones more difficult to place. Now, most people, many people at least outside of Chicago, shrink from the idea of a market in babies for adoption. But the argument against it can't be like the argument against buying and selling friendship with the Nobel Prize, because it would work, at least in the sense that a bought child would be to the parents, to the family, the good would persist. It wouldn't be dissolved or diminished or corrupted by the fact that a market had governed the adoption system. So we have these two different kinds of cases, goods that money can't buy and goods that money can buy but arguably shouldn't. One way of thinking, now here's the next step in my argument. I want to suggest that there is actually a connection between the two. The reasons that money shouldn't buy certain goods are connected to the reasons that money can't buy some of those other goods. And to explore this link, let's consider some cases intermediate between the two. We can't buy friendship, but what about tokens of friendship or expressions of personal relations? I recently read of a company in China that provides an unusual service. Suppose you need to apologize to someone, an estranged lover, or a business partner with whom you've had a falling out. This company in China, called the Tianjin Apology Company, will perform the service for a fee. You can go to the company, pay a fee, and they will apologize on your behalf. The motto of the company, according to this article, is, "We say sorry for you." A Chinese sociology professor told the New York Times, where I read about this, that the company responds to the fact that given the cultural complexity of apologies in China, many people are, quote, apologetically challenged. As described in the article, the company's 20 employees are all middle-aged, college-educated men and women who dress in somber suits. They are lawyers, social workers, and teachers with excellent verbal ability and significant life experience. So, an apology is an interesting intermediate case. If someone you cared about or someone you were angry with sent you a bought apology, would you be satisfied? It might depend on the circumstances or perhaps even the cost. Would you consider a very expensive apology as more meaningful than a cheap one? Here's another example of an intermediate case. Admission to elite universities. Now, typically, university admission is based on merit as measured by exams or other indicators of academic promise. But suppose that Harvard or the LSE decided to increase their revenue by holding auctions for admission, selling admission to the highest bidder. Now, it's worth pointing out that even if they wanted to maximize revenue, these places probably wouldn't auction off all the places in the class. Because if they did that, the honorific aspect of admission would be lost and the demand for enrollment would decline. Oh, that's a place you can just buy your way into. But suppose that most of the places were allocated according to merit, but a small number of places were made available, quietly and discreetly, for children of wealthy families capable of donating large amounts to the university. There is at least one American university that's used this approach with considerable success. But what it illustrates is the double character of higher education as a good. It is, in one sense, a form of honor and recognition that money can't buy, but it's also a form of access and opportunity that universities can, in principle, sell, provided they do so discreetly. Because when admission is known to be bought and sold, the honorific aspect of the good is eroded. So this makes higher education also an intermediate case. It's a good that, to some extent, money can buy, but arguably shouldn't. Now, how does this analysis of the goods that money can buy but shouldn't help us figure out the grounds of objection to market exchanges? Well, it points our attention to at least one objection, and that is that in some cases, turning a good into a commodity can degrade or corrupt it. Now, it's important to distinguish this objection from another familiar argument against buying and selling certain goods. And the familiar argument focuses on the coercive aspect of some market relations. For example, you might be against having a market in kidneys because you worry, especially a global market, you worry that the result would be the poor selling their kidneys to the rich. And you might worry about that, because you would have a sense that when people living, say, in crushing poverty make the choice to sell their kidney for export, let's say, to a rich recipient, they are not, the sellers are not really acting voluntarily. Their consent, the thing that makes market exchange, free market exchange, morally attractive, the consent is tainted or impaired by the necessity of their circumstance. So this objection to the buying and selling of certain goods like kidneys is an objection from coercion. It worries about the coercive effects of market transactions under conditions of severe inequality, and it's a familiar and important objection. But suppose we address that objection by imagining a society, or for that matter, a world, where the background conditions were such that no one lived under a crushing necessity of that kind. Now, people disagree about what fair background conditions would require, whether it would be perfect equality or some other kind of equality. But suppose such a society exists, then would there, in that society, be any further reason to limit markets? Or would it be the case that having addressed the problem of coercion due to inequality, there is no good reason to object to buying and selling anything? Would it be fine in such a society to buy and sell organs? Would prostitution be unobjectionable in a society where we didn't have the sense and the worry that in the background are inequalities such that make the consent not truly voluntary? The argument I would like to advance is that the answer to that question is, yes, there would still be a further objection, independent of the argument from coercion. And this is what I would describe as the argument from corruption. The idea that even with fair background conditions, even with equality in the background, even without the heavy hand of necessity coercing trades, there is still reasons not to allow all goods and all social practices to be governed by market relations. Now, how does this argument from corruption differ from the argument from coercion? The argument from coercion points to one moral ideal, and that's the ideal of consent, making choices for ourselves freely. The argument from corruption is more difficult to make philosophically and politically, because it doesn't point just to one ideal. It points, how do you know if a good or a social practice has been corrupted by marketization? The answer will depend on the nature, on the character of that good. So in order to know for any particular good or social practice whether marketizing it would corrupt it or degrade it, we have to reason from and argue about the nature of that good. My suggestion then is, or my argument, that the argument from corruption is more fundamental than the argument from coercion. It can't be, in the sense that it can't be reduced to the argument from coercion. And secondly, in order to make it out, in order to advance the argument from corruption, we have to be able to reason from the nature of the goods in question. And the reasons will differ depending on whether those goods are kidneys or children or various aspects of civic life. What I would like to do to illustrate the way that kind of reasoning from the nature of the good might unfold, I would like to shift from the kinds of examples I've just been mentioning, books, babies, kidneys, the Nobel Prize, and the like, to consider civic goods that are vulnerable to corruption or degradation if marketized. Now, I don't by this shift in emphasis mean to suggest they're the only kinds of goods that are corrupted in that way, but those are the kinds of goods that have the most direct bearing on politics and on political choices we need to make at a time when markets have a greater momentum and influence and weight and prestige than ever before. So let me take one centrally important civic good, which is citizenship. And citizenship conceived as bound up with the kind of freedom that comes when men and women live under circumstances where they can share meaningfully in self-rule. Now, this idea of citizenship, this civic good, is more demanding than other ideas of citizenship, which consist just of voting in elections to express one's preferences and interests. On the more demanding conception of citizenship that I'm proposing, to be free is to participate in shaping the forces that govern the collective destiny. And in order to do that and to do it well, requires that citizens possess or come to acquire certain civic virtues, a concern for the common good. Now, with this, there's a lot more to be said for and against this idea of citizenship. But let's take that as a way of illustrating, at least, take that ideal of citizenship, this idea of participating in self-rule, of caring for the common good, of not just seeing politics as an arena for the pursuit of private interest. Take that idea of citizenship, and let's look at a couple of political institutions and practices to see whether that good, that civic good, is diminished or corrupted if market practices intrude upon them. Example one, military service. How should military service be allocated? Traditionally, the answer is in one of two ways, by conscription or by the labor market. By the labor market is to say through a volunteer army, a paid army. During the American Civil War, there was an interesting hybrid of the two systems. During the American Civil War, there was conscription by lottery. This was in the North, Abraham Lincoln's first draft. But if you were drafted and you didn't want to fight in the Civil War, you could hire a substitute to take your place. And people ran ads in the classified ad section of newspapers offering $300, $400, $500 for a substitute, and they offered whatever price the market would, the wood would clear the market. Andrew Carnegie reportedly hired a substitute to take his place in the Civil War, and the amount he paid was roughly the same as the amount he spent in a year on fancy cigars. But there was this provision, and when I, well, let's see, just here we can take, can we take just a quick poll by a show of hands? How many people agree with that system, or at least find it unobjectionable? This is the hybrid system. Conscription, but where you can hire. And one, not many economists attended this lecture. How many disagree? How many find it objectionable or troubling? Okay, the majority, but not, it's not unanimous, but a majority. Now, it's interesting to ask, those of you who object, on what grounds would you object? And one reason you might object is that you might consider it unfair for the affluent to be able to hire the less fortunate to fight and die in their place. Does that capture at least some of the worry that those of you who object had in mind? And I certainly would embrace that objection to the Civil War system. But what's interesting, if you think about it, if that's an objectionable feature of the Civil War system, what about today's volunteer or paid army that is used in the United States, in the UK, and in a number of other countries? Now, from the standpoint of market reasoning and efficiency and individual choice, the paid or volunteer army is clearly the best alternative. Conscription is worse, and the Civil War hybrid is somewhere in between. But there are two objections that could be made to the volunteer army. One of them is that in a society with unequal opportunities, the decision to enlist might not be truly voluntary. If poverty and disadvantage are widespread, the choice to serve may simply reflect the lack of alternatives. And in the US, a couple of years ago, Charles Rangel, an African-American congressman from New York, proposed reinstating the draft precisely on these grounds. He argued that those who were sent to Iraq were disproportionately drawn from the children of the working class and especially from among African-American families. So that's one objection. But there's a second objection, and that is that letting people buy their way into and out of military service, even in a society where the choice of work didn't reflect deep inequalities, that doing this treats military service wrongly, as if it were just another job to be allocated by the labor market. Now, the first objection, the one that worries about inequality in the background leading the poor to serve disproportionately, that's the argument from coercion that I was referring to before. That's the one that worries about consent not being adequate. But the second objection goes beyond the question of coercion and consent. According to this second objection, there is a kind of civic obligation that all citizens have to serve their country in some way or other, whether it's best discharged through military service or other forms of national service is a further question. But on this strong civic idea of citizenship, service to one's country isn't the sort of thing that people should be free to buy or sell. And on the second argument, to turn such service into a commodity, just a job for pay, is to corrupt or to degrade the sense of civic virtue that properly attends it. Now, there's a classic expression of this argument. This is the argument from corruption about military service, about civic life. It comes from Rousseau. Remember, he says, as soon as public service, ceases to be the chief business of the citizens, and they would rather serve with their money than with their persons, the state is not far from its fall. When it's necessary to march out to war, they pay troops and stay at home. This is Rousseau. In a country that is truly free, the citizens do everything with their own arms and nothing by means of money. So Rousseau's argument against commodifying military service is a classic instance of what I here have been calling the argument from corruption. It invokes this strong idea of citizenship, what might be called the Republican idea of citizenship. Now, market advocates might defend the volunteer army by rejecting this strong idea of citizenship and denying the idea that there is a civic obligation to serve one's country. But those who defend the use of the labor market to allocate military service should logically be willing to extend that reason, their logic, beyond just what we have now, which is to say paid armies. They should, in principle, and here's the test of the consistency of their view, they should, in principle, be willing to defend the use of mercenaries, or for that matter, the outsourcing to private companies of military, of war. If military service is just another job to be allocated by the labor market, there is no good reason in principle that governments should discriminate in hiring based on nationality. The ideal market solution would turn all armies into a version of the French Foreign Legion. Governments in need of troops should recruit soldiers, on this view, from among citizens of other countries who want the work and possess the relevant qualification. More than mercenaries, though, the logic of the market could be extended to challenge the notion that armies should even be run by the government. Why not subcontract military functions to private enterprise? Now, this isn't a hypothetical question, because today, if you look around the world, the privatization of war is a growing trend. Private companies play an increasing role in conflicts around the world. In fact, they form a large part of the U.S. military presence in Iraq today. One striking feature of that presence is the heavy reliance on soldiers for hire. We don't call them mercenaries these days, we call them private contractors. These private contractors are not just building roads and repairing the electrical grid in Baghdad. Many of the people providing the military protection for the American coalition authority in Baghdad are not members of the U.S. Army. They're employees of private companies hired by the Pentagon. In fact, if you add up the number of security personnel in Iraq, the second largest contingent, bigger than any other country's contribution, second largest after the American military, is not the UK even. It consists of private security contractors. In terms of numbers, the second largest group. So what does this show us? If the Civil War system is objectionable, going back to that hybrid case, if it's objectionable on the grounds that it lets people buy their way out of a civic obligation, then volunteer army, which simply universalizes that practice, must be objectionable on similar grounds. If, on the other hand, military service is just another job to be allocated by the labor market, then the question arises, is there any principal distinction between the volunteer army and private military forces? This is all by way of illustrating, well, two things. First, the distinction between the argument from coercion and the argument from corruption. The argument I've emphasized is the argument from corruption. Second, it's to show that the argument from corruption depends on a certain idea of the good, in this case, the civic good associated with citizenship understood as carrying certain obligations of service. And this is really just to illustrate, it's not meant decisively to resolve the question, should or shouldn't we have a paid military, but if you take seriously that idea of citizenship, then you should be uneasy with marketizing military service. And if you reject that idea of citizenship, then you should be willing in principle to go beyond the volunteer paid army all the way to mercenaries, all the way to private contractors. And that's an illustration of the way in which, going back to my initial claim, that to argue about what is appropriate, what's the appropriate arena for markets, we can't avoid arguing from a certain conception of the good of the practice in question, in this case, national service or military service. Let me mention another example, also to do with citizenship, immigration. Now, immigration is a question that roils the politics and the societies of a great many countries today, in the US, in Europe, in Britain. What should immigration policy be? During an age of globalization when capital flows across boundaries and goods flow across national boundaries, is there any reason in principle why people, and for that matter, membership, shouldn't flow with equal ease across national boundaries? Why should there be one principle, say, for capital flows, and a different principle, the flow of people. Well, you might say when people flood across national boundaries, it's destabilized. The effects can be destabilizing. But as we've seen in the relatively recent past, unfettered capital flows across national boundaries also create enormous instability. In those cases, most economists say yes, but in the long run, it's worth it. But it's interesting that most of those economists don't apply the same sanguine reasoning to the flow of people and immigration across boundaries. No, no, that, they say, would be destabilizing. We need to consider that on non-economic grounds. So that's a challenge worth putting to the ardent advocates of unfettered capital flows, let's say, who are not also in favor of open immigration. But now to go back to my friends and interlocutors, the Chicago economists. Gary Becker, a Chicago economist who has written prolifically about extending the role of markets to traditionally non-market practices, including the family, recently made a proposal to solve the immigration problem through the use of markets, auctioning citizenship, never mind seats in the LSE, auction citizenship, instead of having this whole elaborate debate about who should come, on what grounds, should it be family reunification, should it be skilled laborers versus skilled workers versus unskilled. Set a price on citizenship. You could try $50,000 or $100,000, he suggests. And the effects would be actually very desirable because immigrants who are willing to pay a sizable entrance fee would automatically have characteristics that countries seek in their entrants without point systems or hearings. They would be younger, since young adults would gain more from migrating because they would receive higher earnings over a longer time period. They could make back, say, the $100,000 quicker. Skilled persons would be more willing to pay high entrance fees since they would increase their earnings more than unskilled immigrants would. More ambitious and hardworking individuals would also be more eager to pay for similar reasons. And yes, it's true, he says, some people might not be able to afford it, but then there could emerge a market in loans, immigration loans, just as we have college loans. Tuition is very high. Certainly in the U.S., it's very high. In fact, it's higher than $100,000 for a four-year tuition, four-year private college or university. Anybody have any idea how much? Well, it's about $160,000 right now, going up for 4 years. So citizenship for $100,000 is a bargain. He even did some back-of-the-envelope calculations to determine that the returns to a $100,000 purchase of citizenship for most workers would come more quickly than the returns do in earnings to going to a fancy private university. Well, what about that proposal? What about auctioning off citizenship? Now, insofar as people resist it, shrink from it, say, no, that's not the kind of thing we should be buying and selling, what actually are the reasons, insofar as there are good reasons, it seems to me, they would have to drive us toward leaning on something like the strong notion of citizenship and of the civic good that I described before. Why should citizenship not be put at auction? Well, if it shouldn't, it must be because to be a citizen is to share in a common life of a certain kind, to possess or at least to aspire to certain common purposes and ends, certain virtues of citizenship, and simply to reduce citizenship to a monetary transaction would be to corrupt the civic goods bound up with membership and sharing in a common life. Consider one final example, voting. Now, almost no one, as far as I know, not even the Chicago economists, favor market votes. But I'm not sure they're consistent with their own principles. I think it's just squeamishness on their part, the kind of squeamishness they accuse the rest of us of when we shrink from the use of markets, say, in allocating immigration. Why, if buying and selling votes, if a market in votes is objectionable, why is it objectionable? And more to the point, what are the consequences for commonly accepted electoral practices and understandings of democracy that are arguably analogous to the buying and selling of votes? Take this seemingly simple question. Is there a moral difference, if you think about it, between a politician who bribes people to vote for him or her with cash and a candidate who promises the electorate, say, a tax cut if elected? We prohibit the first, but not only permit the second, we regard that as part and parcel of what democracy is about. Well, here are three possible answers to the question, what's the difference between those two? And all of the answers are unpersuasive. Answer number one, you might say, well, the tax cut comes from public funds, whereas the bribe, that comes from private funds or the party coffers. But this makes the tax cut worse. If you've got to pay off the voters, isn't it better that it be done with private money than taxpayer dollars? So that's not a good distinction. Well, here's the second. You might say the campaign promise of the tax cut might not be kept, so it won't exert as much influence as an out-and-out bribe. But this argument isn't all that good either. It suggests perversely that the moral superiority of the campaign promise for the tax cut is rooted in the fact that the politician who makes it can't be relied upon to keep his word. In any case, if the voters are skeptical about whether the promise will be kept, they can simply assign it, as the economists would say, a discounted value, a promise of a $500 tax cut with a 50% chance of being enacted would be worth $250, but that wouldn't make it justifiable. So the second answer is no good. Third, it might be argued that a campaign promise is public and available to everyone, whereas a bribe is secret and offered only to certain people. But first of all, many campaign promises are also targeted at particular groups. And in any case, if bribes are wrong just because they're offered to some people and not to others, why not universalize them? That's the whole point of a market in votes. If there were an open market in votes, the secrecy would fall away, and everyone would be free to buy and sell at the going rate. And in fact, two election cycles ago, there was on the internet, there was a website called voteauction.com in the US, where someone had designed a system to, kind of like an eBay, only for the election. And it brought together buyers and sellers state by state because of the American electoral system. And they sold each basket of votes by state to the highest bidder. And not surprisingly, you could go and click and see what the price on any given day was. And the price, state by state, varied according to two factors, not surprisingly. States that had the biggest number of electoral votes, obviously those votes were more valuable, and states that were close, where the outcome was in doubt, those votes were more valuable because of the margin, they held a greater chance. Well, there were attorneys, states' attorneys general who tried to close down and did succeed, I think, in closing down this voteauction.com. But in principle, it's not so easy to say why that's wrong and the common familiar bartering and promising of interest group politics is okay. The reason none of these distinctions succeeds is that they share the mistaken idea that the purpose of democracy is to aggregate people's interests and preferences and translate them into policy. This brings us, if that theory of democracy is right, the interest great pluralist aggregative idea of democracy is right, then there is no good reason not to allow markets in votes. But insofar as we shrink from that practice and don't want to buy and sell votes, that indicates that we still do have, to that extent, we still do have a commitment to this stronger, more demanding, more elevated idea of citizenship and democracy that I described. It brings us back to the fundamental conception of the good bound up with this strong notion of citizenship. According to the interest-based theory of politics, citizens are consumers, and politics is economics by other means. But if the consumerist theory of democracy is right, we might as well let vote auction operate. Our reluctance to treat votes as commodities, then, should lead us in the other direction. It should lead us to question the politics of self-interest or the aggregative idea of democracy, which we often take for granted. So here, in the case of voting, in the case of immigration, in the case of military service, are three examples drawn from civic life where buying and selling of a civic good seems objectionable for reasons that go beyond consent to the corrupting or the degrading character. And the good corrupted or degraded in each of these three cases has something to do with this ideal of democratic citizenship. Now, I've suggested here that my main target consists of those laissez-faire, market-loving economists and libertarians, I suppose, who think that freedom consists entirely in the voluntary exchanges that people make in a market economy, regardless of the background conditions that prevail. But I also mean, by this line of reasoning, to challenge those who are not necessarily free market economists, but those liberal consent theorists and others who believe that if only we fixed the inequality of income and wealth in our societies, if only we had fair background conditions within countries and among countries, then we would no longer have to worry about commodification. Then the problem would fall away, because then the problem of the poor peasant selling off his kidney under duress to the wealthy recipient would no longer be the case. What I'm suggesting is that that view is inadequate. And like the view of the pure free market laissez-faire individualist, the liberal consent theorist who's only concerned with distributive justice misses this important feature and question of contemporary public life about the role and the proper role of markets. Both groups are wrong because both overlook the dimensions of life, civic life, but other aspects of life that lie beyond consent in the moral and civic goods that markets do not honor and that money cannot buy. And that's the reason, above all, it seems to me, that we need to try to invigorate the public debate of democratic societies by putting at the center of our political debates the question, how and why should we keep markets in their place? Thank you very much.
You
can stand up.
Yeah.
Do you prefer to stand up, or do you want
to? Either way.
If you need to go for any reason, do so now. Otherwise, you're imprisoned here for the next half an hour for questions and answers. So if you need to go, I invite you to do so in one go rather than in drips and draps, which is difficult if you're trying to have an exchange. Can I just have a sense of how many people would immediately like to ask a question? Several. Okay, at the top, anyone? Do you mind if we take two or three questions and just get a sense of audience concerns? So let me start with you at the front. Yeah.
Sure.
Yep. There's a roaming mic just coming your way, so. On both sides. Okay. So, yeah, quickly.
Well, first of all, of course, thanks for a very stimulating lecture. And I just would like to challenge you a little bit on your distinction. I mean, on the one hand, I totally agree with you. There are certainly goods which may be corrupted by monetizing or commoditizing them, and men maybe sort of use theories of different forms of capital. I mean, be it cultural capital or these kind of forms could be considered. But where I'm not so sure is whether the sort of the mixed cases you've been discussing are really so distinct from the coercion argument. What I mean is that all these sort of dangerous tendencies you've been talking about, such as mercenaries and votes and all this. I mean, there are countless historical precedents for any of them. I mean, selling of offices and, condottieri. I mean, it's all existed before. Mm-hmm. And the main reason why this was resisted was not necessarily only because they represent a good in itself, but maybe not immediately, but in the long run, this corruption would really lead to severe inequality. So I think in the end, it really boils down again to the inequality argument that after a while, a professional army might turn against its own population or might be in the control of the few, or the officers might be, that are bought. Are a tool of perpetuating inequality. So, and why is this important? I think when you argue for different forms of logics in different fields, I mean, that is a good defense, but in a way it keeps the two fields too separate. Whereas, I mean, the political logic was raising the civic above the market and saying the civic rules above the inequalities of the market, whereas you sort of divide them too much for my taste. So isn't it the question of how much can the civic life rule the market rather than how much can the civic life keep the market out?
Gentleman behind you. Do you want to
respond? Yes, I'm in favor of the civic rising above the market and ruling it. I'm in favor of that. Then the question is how? On what grounds? What rules should it enact and enforce? And on what grounds? And to answer those questions, I think we have to engage in the moral analysis. But I'm for raising the civic above the market and having the civic be regulative of the market.
Should we take a second question? Yeah. This.
My name is Jim Kennedy. At 84, I'm no longer affiliated. Your lecture prompts two additional cases that I suggest.
Keep the mic close to you so we can hear you.
Yeah. Before that, I'll just mention perhaps an ancillary consideration in relation to the issue of voting, which it concerns political party contributions, but I'll put that aside.
Yeah.
The two main questions are, in the area of human reproductive technology, it seems to me that all manner of very difficult moral decisions are involved. For example, what effectively amounts to renting a womb. The second area concerns child labor. Should there be the right to sell child labor?
Let me just give quick answers.
Sure, sure. The answer to the second. We're gonna take them one by one.
The answer to the second is no. And the answer to the first is, yes, reproductive technologies do raise questions about commodification, and if you take two cases, you mentioned renting the womb, contracts for surrogate motherhood, commercial surrogacy, should they be permitted or not? I would say no. What about sperm banks? Should men be free to sell their reproductive capacity? And there are sperm banks, commercial sperm banks with donor catalogs that give elaborate descriptions of the physical and other characteristics of the person whose sperm is for sale. I'm against that too. I'm not against in vitro fertilization or artificial insemination, but I am against marketizing it with sperm donor catalogs and the like. One other quick response. There was in the Harvard Student newspaper not long ago an ad for an ad seeking an egg donor. But it wasn't seeking just any egg donor. It said, wanted egg donor with the following characteristics: at least 5'9" tall, athletic, attractive, and with SAT, college entrance scores of 1400 or above. And the amount being offered for an egg from that, the amount being offered for that premium egg was $50,000.
But what about the litigious consequences deriving?
No, I'm against all of that. I'm against that.
I'd just like to remark, it seems to me there's an alternative explanation to cover quite a number of the instances you produced, which is to do with the notion of fairness, and that one could start with markets are not fair.
Well, that's my first argument. That's the argument from coercion, is the fairness argument. That's the one.
Yeah.
All right, so you want to say that can accommodate all of the cases without any remainder.
Well, certainly it seems to me to accommodate the one about the buying your way out of the lottery of military service in the Civil War, or the immigration one. It seems to me you can say it's not fair to that somebody who needs the immigration war for family reasons, say, can't get there. And in case of market unfairness within a society, we have the ability of redistributive taxation to put that right. In cases where there aren't state mechanisms to put it right, then that's the type of case where you say,
all right, but here's, this
can't
is
be allowed to operate.
Right, this is precisely my question. Suppose you had redistributive policies to remedy the unfairness. Then would there be no objections to any of these marketizing practices? I say there would still be, and perhaps you'll say no, and in that case, anything goes. If you redistribute to the point where you remove the unfairness, that's the issue, though.
Well, yes, but when it's a fundamental human interest or right involved, it's difficult to envisage that any redistributive policy that could correct the unfairness is the point I think I'd make.
Well, but the issue is whether even an equal society, if you could redistribute to the point of equality, then would it be fine to buy and sell eggs, sperm, military service, immigration, kidneys, and votes? I mean, you could address it even by just focusing on the question of votes. If you had a sufficiently generous welfare state redistribution, then would it be fine to have a market in votes? Or kidneys?
I don't want to prolong this too long, but I mean, in votes, it seems to me there's a valid argument that's subverting the democratic process.
Oh, well, all right, then. Then you're driven back to a consideration about the civic good or the common good that goes beyond fairness. That's just my point.
Okay, we have a lot of people eager to say something. Should we just try and take a class?
Go ahead.
Because I think some of them might build on each other. So
away.
Let's take the gentleman with the yellow top over there.
With the yellow.
I think the mic is here.
And then we'll move across. Anyone at the top eager to ask a question? It'll come to you. Where's the mic upstairs?
Okay. Can I go ahead?
Yeah, please.
All right.
I think your distinction between coercion and corruption is actually quite remarkable, but I just want to push on the implications of signing up to corruption. Presumably, if you're talking about the intrinsic nature of how to be corrupted, you're going to have to work out the definition of the intrinsic nature of corruption.
Right. Yeah, it's a great question. Great question.
Yeah. Gentlemen over there, yeah. And then the woman behind you.
Quite agree with your distinction, and I like that you put the civic over the market. But what I'm interested in asking is, isn't the strong notion of citizenship already corruptive? If we put it in historical context, which it emerged, isn't it the abstraction equally corrupt? What kind of civic notion or what kind of citizenship are we talking about?
The woman behind you.
if you have complete equality in society and there's nobody who signs up for the military service, so it's kind of like a public good and everybody tries to free ride, and there's an argument against coercion and corruption in market exchange, then what about having the state forcibly ask everybody to sign up to military service? Because that's what happens in Singapore, because there's when men reach the age of 19, they have to take military service for 2.5 years, and it's compulsory. Nobody can get out of it if you want to keep your citizenship. Even the elites or the very rich cannot get out of it. But what they can do is they can buy doctors' recommendations that downgrade them to serving in sections of the military that are easier or have slack jobs, that they can go home at 5 o'clock whilst their peers have to be in camp for years and years. I don't know. So how would you respond to market versus state?
Good. Gentleman over there. Are you all right with this?
Yeah, fine. Cluster? Good.
Yeah, they're just behind you. Behind. Then we'll come up.
For the sake of the argument, I'd like to challenge you on the point of child labor. Presumably, your answer for why child labor is unacceptable is because childhood is one of those values that should not be commodified. And then if we all assume that having a parent is an intrinsic part of childhood, and we all know that spending time with one's children is very intensively commodified, then how can you justify that? If, in terms of opportunity cost, one says, I'm going to take X amount of money and not spend time with my parents, and with my children, sorry. And then more generally, if you're saying that basic human values should not be commodified, are you not opening a can of worms in which basically everything has some sort of value that we wouldn't want to see commodified and get to some sort of Marxian position where, you know, basic human labor is something that should not be commodified?
I'm there, Tom. We'll stop.
Hi. I was wondering if you could answer whether you think your position is too idealistic, if you think that the alternatives for all of the cases that you mentioned is probably worst. I'm not from Chicago, but I'm just thinking that there will always be maybe a black market in organs, and that maybe if you open, I don't know, along those lines of what is a better alternative, is there a realistic alternative in the way that you are proposing to have a civic values over market?
Good. All right, should I take those on? I'll start in going in reverse order. Do I think my view is too idealistic? No. What about black markets inevitably arising? Often they do, black markets in organs, for example, but is that a reason to universalize the practice? There are politicians who do bribe voters. Does it follow from that there's a black market, that therefore it's too idealistic to say we shouldn't have an outright open auction in votes? No, I think there are other solutions, like trying to crack down on bribery. As far as child labor and parental labor, it's true that parents spending time with their children is commodified to a very large extent. I assume you're thinking in the form of nannies and childcare workers and the like. And I don't know that one can reason directly from that precedent to the desirability of commodifying the labor of children. I think one might equally be led to question the existing practice, which is not to say that the care of children should never be carried out by paid workers, but if there, I think, parents in various societies wrestle with this question all the time, to what extent can the parental role be commodified or hired out without doing some damage to the parent-child relation? And there are different traditions of sending kids off to boarding school or having nannies and so on in different societies, and for that matter in different classes within given societies. But I do think it's a live and open question
to whether there is a point at which commodifying the care of children can be in tension with certain values to do with the parent-child relationship. And as far as human labor generally, I don't know that this casts me necessarily with Marx, as was the suggestion, but there is a long and rich history of debate about the legitimacy of wage labor. In fact, and this is really just a historical but morally interesting footnote, the most ardent critics of wage labor as unfree and as wrongly commodifying work in the U.S., in American history, was advanced by the Southern defenders, the ideological defenders of slavery. In fact, if you look at some of these, the most sophisticated among those defenders, they were defending Southern slavery in large part by drawing on Marxian critiques of wage labor as being unfree. And they argued, by comparison with our system, your treatment, the freedom of factory wage laborers is no greater. I don't endorse that argument, but it is an instance of a very long-standing historical argument about the moral legitimacy of wage labor, at least under certain circumstances. I'd like to go back to this really interesting question about the all right, suppose there is something to the argument from corruption as against coercion, such that we have to argue with respect to each contested case about the nature of the good at stake to know whether it's vulnerable to corruption by marketization. How, the question comes, how can we reach a definition of the intrinsic good? And I understand the question, this might enlarge it even a bit, especially given the fact that in pluralist societies like ours, and perhaps this is behind your worry, right, there are all kinds of disagreements about the meaning of goods in social practices. And I think that you're right to fasten on that as a worry, because part of the appeal of trying to cast all of the arguments about markets into the argument about inequality, fairness, and coercion is that if we can dispense with this question only in those terms, we don't have to embroil ourselves in debates about the meaning of social goods. And so it seems less controversial, less politically fraught, less contestable, because these arguments about fairness and coercion and equality and distributive justice all share this feature with free market philosophies. They're all arguments about the conditions of consent. The ideal at stake is the ideal of consent, about which there's relatively little dispute as an ideal. And the only argument is, what does it mean to realize consent? And now there are political debates between libertarians and social welfare advocates, or social contractarians. But these are debates about consent, a seemingly less controversial ideal. And if we can resolve all social and political questions within that framework, it would seem to spare us recourse to these contested questions about the good. And here's how this whole discussion about markets actually connects up with debates about liberal political philosophy, to which David referred at the outset. I don't think in this case or in the other cases that consent and debates about consent are can be wholly self-sufficient, either philosophically or politically, from debates about the good. And so I don't think there is any single answer to the question, how can we sort out the good in a way that everyone will agree. Everyone would agree. Which is to say, these debates are uncontested, intrinsically contested terrain. But my suggestion is we can't avoid having them unless we're prepared to give up on an important range of social goods and practices that can't be preserved or protected or accommodated from markets solely within the framework of fairness, consent, and individual choice.
I think this is very persuasive and does raise a set of questions that the liberal consent theorists would find difficult. But the analytical work that you can do with the second range of arguments depends to some extent on addressing this question about the core idea that of the good that is being violated.
Right.
I mean, because every single example requires some analytical account to do the work. So let's go back to child labor. What's wrong with child labor? Well, the empirical work that I've been doing as part of a project on global governance in India shows very clearly that if you take a strong ILO, International Labour Organization, view of what's wrong with child labour, you damage then, and put that into a force in certain regions and communities in India, you damage the economic prospects for families very, very acutely. And actually, in the end, the family and familial and welfare circumstances, families deteriorate.
Right.
So the argument that has a strong liberal inflection that child labor is inherently wrong because it damages the autonomous development, let's say, of children, does very dangerous work in some contexts.
Yeah.
So what is wrong with child labor? So in order for your argumentative structure to deliver goods at this point, you need to say either that's an issue that can be tackled within the machinery you want to mount here, or there's some issues where we will not agree on what the nature of the intrinsic nature of the good is, and therefore the work that you'll be able to do, as it were, on those issues of the good is going to be very minimal.
Well, I don't think it will be minimal. In the case of the child labor, the cases in India that you describe, we would have to, it would be relevant to find out just what the meaning, the social meaning and the actual consequences of child labor are for families, not just for the economic well-being, but for the family structure, for example. And if it turned out that not only from the standpoint of wealth and GDP, but also from the standpoint of strengthening rather than weakening family structures, that child labor under certain circumstances contributed to rather than eroded the parent-child relation, the family structure, and so on, then that would be an argument for child labor, and it would be an argument from, not just from wealth generation, but from the good at stake, namely the relation between parents and children and the goods that strong family structures can provide. So I would be open to that in that kind of case, but that empirical study, investigation, is precise. It's if it's of that kind, not just looking at correlations between child labor and wealth, but the effect on family structure and so on, then that would be an investigation about the effect of child labor on the good of family life. That would be within the good. That wouldn't just be about fairness and consent. And I would be swayed if it turned out that those were the effects. Okay. That would be the kind of test.
We've got just a few more minutes. Yeah, gentleman at the back.
Just to go back to the contrast between the coercion and corruption, I wonder if that distinction doesn't play out better if you take as your sort of definition of equality or fairness some view which seeks to equalize something according to sort of one currency or matrix. What instead if you see fairness as actually involving the blockage of exchanges between different spheres, such as the sphere of money and politics, and actually seeks to police those boundaries? And that account seems to sort of incorporate something of the corruption model, but it focuses your attention on saying we can sort of perceive a necessary sort of boundary which we have to keep clear on, and we can be clear that that sphere shouldn't sort of be elided with and seep into the other one.
Right.
But the focus is less on seeking to isolate some intrinsic good in a particular sphere which you're seeking to sort of preserve and bolster from outside interference.
I'm perfectly happy with casting this in terms of blocking exchanges across spheres where the exchanges would be somehow inappropriate or objectionable. So that much of it, the idea of blocked exchanges across spheres, is perfectly in line with the account that I'm offering. But then the question arises, what constitutes the relevant spheres? How do we know which exchanges between which spheres should be blocked and which shouldn't? And what reasons can we point to? And in order to answer those questions, I think we are driven unavoidably to articulate the goods, the moral goods, the civic goods, the social goods, that are characteristic of the spheres we're trying to protect. So as a way of framing the question, I'm perfectly happy with the idea of blocking exchanges between spheres. But I think that frames the same question in a perfectly congenial way, but I don't think it displaces the need for reasoning about the good. We need to reason about the good if we're to know what constitutes a sphere and whether or to what extent monetizing that sphere would be undesirable.
Robert,
Robert Wade, LSE. Right. You've been talking about domains where there are issues of keeping markets in or out using criteria like fairness, consent, coercion, and so on. But there's another category of issues which falls under the heading of keeping markets in their place, that it's not a matter of markets versus other domains, it's a matter of different ways of institutionalizing markets. I'm thinking, for example, of the difference between stereotypically US corporations and Japanese corporations. Japanese corporations have, say, lifetime employment, promotion from of the CEO from within rather than being recruited from an external labor market, and are run for the benefit of a wide set of stakeholders as distinct from simply shareholders. There's a very strong view in the US coming from Chicago and your friend Larry Summers, for example, that would say that Japanese corporations have gone up the wrong road. They should become more like US corporations. But in the Japanese notion, many Japanese think that their way of institutionalizing markets, keeping market forces working in the corporation, between corporations, is a better way. It's not just instrumentally, but it is a better way to organize economic life than the US way. And all I'm really asking you is whether you think your approach from moral philosophy has any handle on that set of issues as distinct from the set of issues you've been dealing with.
Right, we're almost running out of time. I'm going to have to choose at random two people to ask a brief question rather than a comment. And then I'm sorry, no good at reasons, we're going to have to stop other than the time limit.
Yes, I was disturbed partly by what you said about the market allocating immigration in the United States, because at the moment, if you have $1 million, you can very easily get entry into the United States and get a green card or passport or whatever. So the price at the moment is about $1 million. If you have that, you're welcome. And what disturbs
And so would you formalize and extend that practice? Is that what you're saying?
And no, it's already in place. In other words, you are saying you
right. Well, that's like this case of the bribe, you know, because there are some people who bribe, politicians who bribe, therefore it doesn't follow that we should universalize vote buying and selling.
I think it's a dreadful thing.
Then you're on my side of that argument.
But in terms of markets and morals, I feel that markets have been changing and undermining and corrupting morals and morality, and that is a whole area which somehow has escaped the attention of most people, is how the markets have really been undermining the whole moral structure. And so if you're trying to, say, keep markets in their place is changing because morality is changing as well.
Thank you.
Last at the top, sorry.
Yeah, I have sympathy for a lot of the things you've said, but I guess where I'd like some help, that there seem to be places where your concern about monetization or commoditization is really, it's not a concern in and of itself, it's that it will allow some group to violate the norm in some public way. And the market mechanism is just the mechanism that allows them to do that, but what troubles you is that they're violating this social good which we need to define. And so I'd like to know how you think about that, and also how you prescribe these areas of social good, because the danger that I see is, you know, in the U.S., constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage could be construed as we have this social good, which is marriage, and we need to protect that, and we can't allow these people freedom to do what they want because it's going to destroy our sort of social good. So I don't see in some areas you're really arguing against markets. In certain areas you're arguing against choice, and I don't think that's what you mean, but I don't see where you draw the line.
I regret that's where we'll have to end questions.
You
get a few moments,
all
and
right.
Then I get the final word.
Yes, okay. That's only fair, and it's not corrupt.
It's my rules. It's probably unfair.
Part of what I'm, to address the last question first, part of what I'm arguing for does amount to certain constraints on some choices that individuals would otherwise make. The appeal of markets is that they seem to honor choices and aggregate individual choices, and we know lots of ways in which markets fail to do that. And insofar as we need to argue from certain important social and civic goods to limit markets, it will involve some restraint on individual choice. Does that make it analogous to the restraints on individual choice being proposed to prohibit same-sex marriage? That seems a bit far afield, but I see the connection, and I think the worry lying behind your question in this respect. Part of what I'm arguing, the way I suggest that we argue for restraining markets in the name of the goods of social practices, does reflect my general view, which David has already mentioned, that liberal consent theory alone is an inadequate public philosophy. And so maybe that's why you worry that that general view in the case of the same-sex marriage would have no way of fending off those who want to prevent it. I think even in that case, the argument, the defense of same-sex marriage has to include a substantive argument about the good of the social practice of marriage of a kind that includes gays as well as heterosexual partners. I don't think that consent theory alone is adequate even to deal with the same-sex marriage case, but that's in a way a question to elaborate another day. Just to come back to the Japanese companies and different ways of institutionalizing markets, the way this analysis, I think, would connect with those kinds of questions, the Japanese lifetime employment as against the American system of slashing and burning, is to notice the sense in which almost all market institutions, including corporations, are amalgams in practice of market norms and of non-market norms. The Japanese corporation case that you describe is a good example of a company, which is a market institution, that is governed in large part by non-market norms to do with lifetime employment and the stakeholder idea and so on. So that's how this analysis, I think, can inform and contribute there. Here I would end with another example. The examples you gave about the corporation were to do with employment compensation and so on. In the case of universities, now, universities are governed by market principles in the sense that professors are paid. We're paid for what we do, you and I. And a professor who gets a better offer of a higher salary or other benefits at another place is free to leave one university and go teach elsewhere. So in some respects, university employment is a market relation. But it's not a thoroughgoing market relation. Adam Smith proposed that professors be paid according to the attendance at their lectures. He thought he thought it would have the desirable effect of combating the tendency toward laziness of professors who don't have to answer to mark. See, the students appreciate this, I think, more than well, what? How would universities be different? And would they be different for the worse if market principles were extended more fully, paying according to the attendance at lectures, charging students? Suppose students want to attend, certain classes are overcrowded, others have low enrollment. What would the students think of charging a premium for classes that are overcrowded and offering a discount for classes looking for customers? Immanuel Kant, in his first job at Heidelberg, was paid according to the attendance at his lectures. I can't imagine that Kant was a riveting lecturer, but I think he lectured on some 26 different subjects at the time. It may have had something to do with market principles. But in any case, this is even just as in the case of books, seemingly things that are commodities have many non-marketable, non-commodifiable features, it's true even of apparently market institutions like companies, not to say universities, I hope. David?
Well, my final word is actually very simple, but turns out to be theoretically very sophisticated, because I like to, from the point of view of liberal consent theory and from the point of view of non-corruption theory, thank you for a very good and excellent lecture. I think it was extremely thought-provoking and one of the few lectures that I've been to for some time where actually the question she's raised will stay with me for quite a long time. So thank you very much.
Thank you, David.